heard this. The question was, isn't the word difficult, which I've been using, just another label? Well, in many senses, yes, it is just another label. We could actually just say this is life.
This is what's happening now.
This is what's happening now.
Difficult.
Yeah. But the tendency is, I think, in our ordinary experience, is to see certain dimensions of that experience, which is basically the flow of life that we're engaged in, as being more problematic, more difficult in some way, in scare quotes. And hence the reason, I mean, in the early Buddhist diagnosis, hence the reason why we'll be engaged in what I call strategies of craving. Yeah, to try, for example, to bring some happiness in a life that often has many, many vicissitudes. You know, many good things which we want to hold on to, but many unpleasant things we often want to avoid. And so it's kind of really just facing up to that. Now, I personally couldn't care less what word we use. It's just saying, you know, how are we going to approach what is there in our experience, rather than evade it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you say energy.
The question is when I use the word energy towards the end of what I had to say, was I meaning samatha? Samatha is a calming approach that we can use, which is often opposed to another strategy which many of you will have heard of called vipassana, which is insight meditation. No, it isn't that, actually. What we're talking about energy is the energy or the passion which you bring.
Effort.
Yeah. Effort is another word that's often used, and it's used synonymously. Actually, two different words in the original language. But what I really wanted to emphasize in using the word energy and why I used it was because in the original language it has this degree of wanting to face up to things. Yeah. Not wanting to avoid things. So even in that word, the word difficult, it means approaching the difficult as opposed to avoiding it. That is contextual. Yeah. How much internal and external mindfulness could there be? Because the question was implying that I could be so internally mindful I get run over by a bus. Or possibly get run over by a bus. It's contextual. There's actually something that's within this tradition as well, which is called wise attention. Yeah. It's actually an attention which actually is up to the job. Yeah. So, for example, it might not be a form of wise attention to be engaged in it whilst trying to cross Euston Road. Yeah. To engage in that. That would actually be unwise attention in that particular instance. Whilst sitting on a cushion, engaging in my meditation practice, it might be absolutely wise attention to engage in this internal reflection, this standing close to internal experience. Whereas actually, when we're walking and engaging in the ordinary life, the wise attention is bringing that mindful present moment awareness to what I'm actually engaged in. Like crossing the road. Being aware. Yeah, so, a lot of it hinges on wise and unwise attention. Okay, this is a question about energy. The questioner is quite struck by the amount of energy that goes into craving and aversion. Yeah, actually, we're very profligate, aren't we, with our energy when it goes into craving and aversion. It's trying to avoid what I don't want and trying to get what I want. You know, in our lives. This is a hugely dominating factor in our lives. Now, when we come to sitting, in a sense, what's the energy levels that are required for that? Well, actually, I would say, again, looking at it from this early Buddhist tradition, it's a balanced energy. Yeah? When we look at, say, let's take one of the basic teachings that I'm sure many of you have at least come across, if not familiar with, which is the Eightfold Path. Towards the end of the path, in fact, the Eightfold Path, the third factor from the end, is called, actually, right effort. Now, there's another way I translated the word sama, which actually is a right, which is appropriate effort. What's the appropriate effort required for this task? Yeah, particularly meditation. Well, the appropriate effort is a balanced effort. And this is, I think, reflected throughout Buddhist traditions, which again have a very particular understanding of this. For example, in the Tibetan tradition, they have the notion of getting the mind's effort as if spinning a thread. Now, you've got to remember that Tibetan society was pretty well a medieval-type society prior to 1959. So if you were spinning wool or cotton, you would be spinning it in the old-fashioned way. You know, you dropping down and getting the tension right so it would spin. Now, if you had too little tension on it, it would get tangled up. Mm. If you had too much, it would snap. Okay, so getting the balanced effort was incredibly important. And in fact, there's a whole meditation procedure in some of the Tibetan traditions which actually deal with getting the effort in the mind right. Yeah? So it's not too vigorous, but it's also not too lax. Yeah. And this is a kind of trial and error business. It's not something you can say, well, you do this and this and this. You really got to watch it. I mean, sometimes when I see beginners involved in meditation, you say, sit and watch the breath, I can almost internally see them going, you know, everything kind of contracts in their attempt to hold on to the breath. And I kind of go, please relax, you'll give yourself a headache. Because you have to get the effort right. You have to get the balance right of what you're engaging in. The basic gist of where you start off with that question was about the Buddha actually says in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the sutta which actually most of these practices are based on, he actually says to be mindful or to be aware, to be present in sitting, standing, walking and lying down. Right? It's basically all the postures that we inhabit, isn't it? So we're not just talking about the sitting, although the sitting is what I like to refer to as a nice little laboratory experiment that we engage in, you know, whereby we get a chance to really begin to look at our experience in a particular way. He was talking about bringing that kind of awareness to just the ordinary tasks of life, just the ordinary things that we engage in. I'm always struck by something that Christina Feldman says, I think she says it in one of her books, which is mindfulness isn't difficult, remembering to be mindful is difficult. Yeah. That's the difficulty that we often have, remembering, because, and I'm sure Chris will explore this with you, we fall into what in MBSR and MBCT, particularly MBCT, we call automatic pilot. That's the deluded mind. Yeah, the automatic pilot, the automaticity with which we do things and get caught up in just reacting to what is occurring in our experience. With this particular stance, which we're exploring with you today, particularly even in regard to the body, we are in a sense building in choice. Yeah? To see the mind-body beginning to react. And we can see this, you know, because the body reacts just as well as the mind does. You know, the body will react in particular ways, for example, to reach out and grab that piece of chocolate. You know? And what we are, in a sense, doing with mindfulness is actually building in a dimension of choice. Now, as you will probably know, engaging in this practice, what we begin to do is to begin to see our experience more clearly, because in a sense it becomes slower. Yeah? When we're in ordinary life, things are happening extremely quickly. Extremely quickly. You don't get a chance. As I often say in some of the courses I teach, I don't actually see craving arising for a piece of chocolate or a cup of coffee. I just find myself eating it. Yeah? Yeah? We don't actually, we're not aware of that whole process. Now, in this experiment, which I call sitting practice, meditation practice, or even walking practice for that matter, we get a chance to slow down things and to possibly see what is arising both mentally and physically within us, which will drive often those compulsions, those forms of reactivity. Once we have that, once we have the awareness of craving arising, then I have the choice whether to go down it, that route, or not. And so there is something very fundamental here in liberating ourselves from it. And I might say, by the way, that there's a big word often used in Buddhism which has actually moved into the English language. I'm going to use the Sanskritic form because most people will know it in its Sanskritic form, which is nirvana. And almost this is related to as a kind of Buddhist heaven. And it isn't. Nirvana literally is an unbinding from habitual reactiveness. This is what it is. It's actually a freeing. It's a burning out of that which sustains reactiveness. Nirvana is not a place. It's not a state. It's a skill. You know, what I see within these big books like this, actually, is not a set of doctrines and, you know, a sort of Buddhist theology. What I find within these texts, as in Satipatthana Sutta, the one which all these mindfulness practices are based on, what I see actually is a set of skills training manuals. Nothing else. Mm. You know, if you want to develop certain skills, then it's worthwhile having a look at these. Because it gives a very wise psychological reason for developing them. One particular skill is the skill to nirvana. You know? And rather than a noun form, it's a verb form, so it's nirvanaing. How often are you nirvanaing? Most of the time, it's the unbinding from habitual reactiveness. Habituated states of mind and body. It's actually derived from quite a number of different roots in the Pali, which is to untie, to unbind, to put out, to go out. And what it indicates is the going out of the forces which drive that habitual reactiveness. I really must pass it over to Chris now.